Hello and welcome to the AV Forums podcast for Monday the 10th of February. It's our first home AV, TV and hi-fi podcast of the year. And just a reminder, this is our new format. So if you're audio only, you get the full length podcast and it's available on the second Monday of every month around about 7 p.m. on your podcast provider. If you want to watch us on YouTube, you will get the video shorts. So each little section of the podcast splits out into its own video. You'll find them on the main YouTube channel. They will be available on Mondays as well and later in the week. Screen Time from AV Forums, that's our movies, streaming, disc podcast. That's available on the fourth Monday of every month as an audio-only full-length version. And again, various sections of that podcast will break out into video shorts and you'll find that on the Screen Time with AV Forums channel, which is on YouTube as well. So you've got two YouTube channels. You've got the main AV Forums YouTube channel. Subscribe to that. And you've also got the Screen Time with AV Forums YouTube channel. Subscribe to that as well to get the both of the podcasts. And of course, audio only available from your podcast provider. For this edition, I'll be joined by AV Forums Hi-Fi editor, Ed Selly. I'm also joined by AV Forums news editor, Ian Collin. And in this episode, we're looking TV-wise at Philips' launch event, which happened in Barcelona last week at the time of recording this podcast. They announced their OLED and mini LED TVs for the year, as well as other products. We'll go through that in some detail. There is a video already available with an interview, but we are going to deep dive in this episode. And also, hi-fi-wise, do you need to use Room EQ with a two-channel hi-fi system? It's well used in AV systems, but should you be using it with a hi-fi? More and more products coming with the capabilities to do that. So should you do that? That's coming up also in the podcast today. And don't forget, if you do enjoy our content and our podcasts, then please do consider telling your friends and your peers. Get them out into Facebook groups and other things. Make sure that people can find AV Forums and our podcasts if you do appreciate them. Room EQ, well known in AV circles, but for hi-fi and two-channel, do we need it? This is going to be a contentious.
But do you know what? I think I'm going to really disappoint you here. I think it's going to be less less contentious than perhaps people might assume.
Okay.
There is a point of contention, but no, I don't. I'm not here to be a Luddite. Just as a spoiler for how the next sort of 35 minutes is going to go.
Great. So I guess what we need to do, first of all, before we get into the whole subject, there are numerous various different ways of EQing your hi-fi system or your home theatre system. There are some big brands with their technology. So we've got Odyssey, which you'll find on Marantz and Denon equipment and other bits and pieces here and there. You'll also find Dirac. Dirac seems to be more of a cost option on a lot of AVRs and hi-fi and so on. You need to buy the license, but then you can access Dirac and Dirac Live. ARC Genesis. ARC is Anthem's version of Room EQ. We've also got YPAO, which is Yamaha's version. So you I don't know if you get it on their hi-fi equipment or not.
No, it has made a small inroads. The RN2000, which we reviewed a couple of years ago and I liked very much, made use of a cut down two-channel version of YPAO. But it, as you're right, as it's only Yamaha, it's only when they elect to use it, and they don't elect to use it very often.
Okay, we've also got Trinov Room Optimizer. Now Trinov, more of a multi-channel brand, not so much two-channel. But then another one which has been in hi-fi circles for a long time, that's Lingdorf and their Room Perfect. So those are the technologies basically we're going to be talking about. There are other options. If you have a Rune system in your home, you have the ability to also go in and adjust EQ and take measurements and so on. And of course, you don't need to use these Room EQ systems. You can use a parametric EQ system and a microphone and a bit of free software called REW or RU. You can use that as well. Take measurements of your room and then make adjustments to EQ systems or standalone EQ systems. Or you can get the whole auto EQ system. So with all of that explanation out of the way.
Very artfully done, I thought. Done in not a lot of time as well.
Thank you. And I'm also going to put another option on here, which is forget about Room EQ and get your room right to start with.
Well,
I know it's the old cliche and we keep coming back to it, but the room is the most important part of any audio system. So Ed, I guess we start at the start and say if there are things that you can do to the room in terms of adding absorption to first reflection points or a bit of diffusion to help break up sound waves and so on. That's something that we should be talking about and looking to first of all. And it doesn't have to be fancy diffusers or anything. It can be something as
No.
simple as a book stand.
People get into mind that, there's nothing between having a normal room and coating it in egg boxes and, doing all sorts of unspeakable things. You're absolutely right. Careful use of furniture, careful use of wall decorations, and the simple expedience of placing your speakers with any degree of sort of, optimal thought goes a huge way. I mean, you can use, as we shall cover, a number of these systems to make good on these errors. But if you don't have to correct them in the first place, you're making your life fundamentally simpler. One, you can choose pieces of equipment that don't necessarily go in for EQ. But even if you do go in for equipment with EQ, and there are cogent arguments as for why you might want to do that, even with optimal speaker placement. Fundamentally, if you can undo the problem in the analog domain, you are making your life simpler when it comes to then applying digital corrections, because there is less to do. My room here that I use for the bulk of AV Forums reviews does not have specialist room treatment, but you can find sweeps of it on occasions when I've reviewed Dirac equipment. There'll be another set going up in the not too distant future. Fundamentally, it's a well-behaved room. I mean, I have the benefit of it being a decent rectangle shape. It is proportionally ideal. It's got concrete floors, but more sort of presciently, it's full of furniture. It's got a fat bloke in it. And there's a rug on the floor at exactly the point where reflections break, do their first bounce after coming off a pair of loudspeakers, and it makes an enormous difference. You take the rug out. I don't mean to sound like the Big Lebowski here. You take the rug out and the room sounds significantly different. It does actually, in a small and acoustic way, tie the room together. If you can do these things, even if you then proceed down a path of EQ work, you're just reducing the amount of work that the EQ system is going to have to do. And there's a caveat to why that's important, and we'll come to that a little bit later on. But yes, we've done numerous, well, say numerous, we've done at least a couple of podcasts on placement, positioning, and room items. And the forum is absolutely chock full of people doing everything from borderline egg boxes on ceilings through to just working out how to quell certain aspects of behavior. Somebody somewhere on the forums in the years that we've been doing this will have been dealing with an issue that you will be dealing with. And there is a wealth of information uncorrupted by AI and other gibberish
Yeah,
that will
absolutely.
tell you how you might go about correcting this manually before you set about trying to make corrections on the equipment itself.
And things like bookcases, Ed, at the back of the room just to break up.
Yes, books are, generally speaking, quite remarkably absorbent. And of course,
Well, just to your side. Yeah,
if
just
you're a
to your side
turntable
as well.
user, these, I mean, ironically, these are not in my listening room. But they are, so long as you pay a little bit of attention to where the records are relative to the shelving, they are quite remarkably absorbent. It amuses me that online you'll find a number of people who are very, very skeptical. Oh my goodness, I'm not having a good day today, who have serious issues with room EQ, but they have listening rooms that are absolutely chock full of records, and they have unwittingly treated the room to quite extraordinary levels of dampness, but they've just done it so subconsciously and over such a length of time that they haven't really noticed that they've been applying room treatment in a fairly linear fashion for decades and decades and decades. So yes, you don't need to reach straight for the studio refugee equipment. You can do an awful lot to improve the behavior of your room.
And you made a really, really important point there, which is don't over dampen the room. So I showed you those panels and stuff, and this room is fabric covered, but deliberately, there's a lot of walls that haven't got any treatment on them because you still want that reverb in various parts of the room. And again, with the bookshelves and record shelves and that kind of thing, you want diffusion as well to break up the sound waves as well. So there's really a lot of tricks that you can use. Even a big rug, as Ed says, on the floor, if you've got hardwood floors, which I have in this room, play around with it. See what happens. And the best thing you could possibly do, and we're going to move on to EQ systems, is go and buy a measurement microphone. It will be your best friend. You don't have to get too technical with stuff. It plugs into a laptop. You use some free software. And within 5-10 minutes, you'll have a far better idea of what your room is actually like. And then you can set about even just moving bits of furniture, Ed, and it'll have a big effect on your room before you even touch EQ.
Yes, absolutely that. This leads on to a fairly sensible question, which is when we talk about parametric EQs and systems like that, and then items with Dirac and Room Perfect and other things, ultimately, there's no little fundamental difference. There is one or two in terms of what these pieces of equipment are doing. The difference is purely that Room Perfect and Dirac, what you're paying for is tremendously powerful processing software to run the calculations for you and apply them. We've looked at equipment at very sensible money. In recent history, we've looked at items like the Wim Ultra. I've got the Wim Amp Pro under test. Literally, I've taken a break out from writing about that to do this podcast. And then items like the Eversolo DMP88. These items have got parametric and indeed an old-fashioned graphic equalizer-style EQ slider system. And they can, I mean, the Eversolos one in particular is tremendously flexible. It has a lot of fine adjustments over an extremely fine sort of band set across the full frequency response. You can get quite extraordinary responses out of it. In theory, and we're going to, this is where it gets potentially contentious. In theory, they are capable of the same results that something with Dirac, maybe not Room Perfect, but something with Dirac is capable of doing. The caveat is, I'm pretty confident that Phil could sit down with his microphone and the not inconsequential levels of experience he has measuring rooms for very, very long periods of time and get those results very close between Dirac and him working with the EQ systems on these products with a microphone. What I'm going to say is that the cost extra for Dirac is buying you time saved, and it avoids you disappearing down a rabbit hole of insanity as you start trying to iron out something. You'll push down in one position, you'll get a bump in another, and so on and so forth. It's like pulling a rug with marbles underneath.
Well, it's not just that as well. You're then getting into time domain, you're getting into phase issues, you're getting it, and that's the rabbit hole that you start going down. And even a lot of experienced people in the industry end up going down rabbit holes with their demo rooms and stuff like that, because you get so infatuated by what you're looking at in terms of the graph, you actually forget what it is that the end goal that you're trying to go for. If you, there's no such thing as perfection in anything. Even though one of the systems is called Room Perfect, there is no such thing. But it's trying to find the optimal settings for your space, where basically you, and it's a bit of a cliche, but it's almost like lifting a veil on your system, or one of the things I say is like taking your glasses off because they were covered in Vaseline and suddenly seeing a picture that looks amazing. It's the same with sound, you know, it's like cotton buds out of your ears. Suddenly everything is coherent and you can hear things that you've never heard on your system before and so on. It's not magic. It's just getting
is a reason why Dirac has two licenses. It's got a base management license and then it's got full spectrum, which you pay more for. The overwhelming majority of serious issues that people are going to have in rooms is with unruly bass, nodes, booms, and essentially, choosing my words carefully, if you do what Phil says and you choose a decent microphone software and you pay attention and you don't, you give yourself a whole day to do it properly, you can get a bass node and other sort of, you know, single points of grief dealt with pretty easily without necessarily resorting to paid software. And so on and so forth.
I mean, at the end of the day, Ed, it comes down to mathematics and waveforms and so on. And it's getting your head around that. Now, you made the very pertinent point. If people don't want to go to that kind of length and that kind of hassle, and they just want something that works, this is where these systems pay for themselves, basically, because they fix all of that. If you're somebody who likes to tweak with things and mess around with things and so on, you will get the enjoyment out of looking at measurements, moving, moving a speaker just a centimeter in a different direction can have a huge effect. But again, we're talking about mathematics. You can put your room dimensions in and you can fairly easily work out where you're going to have your dips and your troughs and your peaks and your room nodes and everything else. You more or less work that out, and the software just helps you narrow that down. And then it's how you apply the correction to whatever the issue is in your room. And again, this software, as you've said, it does all the hard work for you. It's running the mathematical models, it's looking at your measurements, and then it's applying what it's then working out as the best settings for your room.
And essentially, with a lot of issues that you've got, with a little bit of time, you can do it using included parametric EQ on products like the WIMS and so on and so forth. They will get an enormous amount of the work done at a very, very, very reasonable price. It's incredibly effective and it's incredibly well keenly priced as well. Where things get complicated is if you really are up against it, if you have older houses, and I do mean several hundred years old, although, and also ironically, in certain instances, brand new houses have some interesting things going on with insulation and how they've been constructed, you can find yourself rapidly dealing with quite significant issues, often far higher up the frequency response than I have to say has been the case in houses that I've lived in over the years. This is where the paid software really starts to earn its keep, because essentially it can use hundreds and hundreds of, if you like, it's a crude form of AI in so much as it's been learning all of this time. It has a huge amount of, resource experience based into what it's been doing that can be used to then be applied to your system, and it will start to do things where all but the most skilled and patient of operatives are not necessarily likely to get with a microphone and just the EQ settings and so on and so forth. That's where things do start to make a bit of a difference. There's something else as well, and this is not specific to two channel, but it does appear to be perhaps more of an issue for two channel. If you have really serious issues, sort of either dips or more specifically troughs that are sort of 2 or 3 dB deep at certain points, the temptation is then to just start whacking on the curves and flatten that out. I'm infuriated because I spent an hour last night trying to find it on AV forums. There is a thread somewhere on AV forums where someone was very, using the WIM parametric EQ software, and they couldn't for the life of them work out why, when they actually flattened the trough, things started sounding really bad, because in theory it shouldn't. The trough's been corrected. Unfortunately, so much additional power is required from was required from the amplifier to correct the trough that they were getting audible distortion at the point where they were actually applying this huge boost. And this is where even systems that are one box, we've recently done the NADC 700 V2, it's got Dirac and so on and so forth. Even when the system is all tied together, Dirac knows, or is at least pre-programmed with the limitations of how much additional power is available and so on and so forth. But even then, it's not foolproof because it can't take into account the current demands of the speakers and so on and so forth. If you've got really serious issues, EQ is going to potentially just throw up different ones in the pursuit of solving those issues. It doesn't happen terribly often, and I genuinely believe it happens more often in the multi-channel domain, but people perhaps aren't quite so attuned to what's going on, because actually the level of dynamic sort of warmth is it's sort of quicker moments of enormous explosiveness. But you can, if you're not paying attention to the requirements and abilities of the other equipment in the chain, start to pull, have demands beyond what it is that they can fulfill. So you need to pay some attention to this, because I wish I could have found the link, because it's an
I
instructive link.
mean, one of the first things that you should be reading up on if you're going to do this yourself is that you pull it down, you never push it up. So if you've got a peak, try and bring the peak down. a certain amount. Never try and take anything up by adding, even just 1 dB, the amount of extra power you then are asking or demanding of the amplifier. And again, there's no such thing as a perfect room. There are other ways of dealing with issues like that. And again, it's all mathematics and it's all models. And this is where EQ, especially the auto EQ systems, can work to your advantage, because they'll never pull things up in a way that it's going to cause distortion. They'll very lightly touch on that. In more cases than anything else, they'll actually be bringing it down.
Yes.
This is where it gets complicated. This is where you start running into trouble and so on. It's not something you're going to learn overnight. Acoustics is something that does take quite a bit of sitting down reading. I've done training workshops over the years from THX and other bodies and so on, and learning about it and applying it. Again, there's no quick fix. If you're somebody that likes to tinker, though, it's great to learn. It's great to get in there and understand what it is that you're doing. And if you can make corrections before relying on EQ, absolutely do it, because the better the room, and the better the room response, the better result you're going to get when you do run EQ, because it has less to do. It's using less of its computing power or less of the power of the system to correct things. So this is where it gets interesting. Not Ed, given a choice, are you applying EQ in your system?
Do you know what? This is where perhaps there's a bit of a surprise to this. Yes, if I had access to a Dirac product, I would be using Dirac. Right, if a Dirac product was routinely in the system, I mean the NAD M66 product of the year for last year, there's no way you'd be buying that and not making use of just how superlative a result you can get across multiple inputs, across the whole range of things you could conceivably connect to it in an utterly painless way. The other thing is, the reason why I say this is, in the time that I've been using Dirac product for two-channel reviewing, Dirac itself has learned some lessons. It's a matter of public record that the resident test speakers here for equipment at that sort of price point is the Kudos Titan 505. Now, heresy moment, the Titan 505 does not have a completely flat response. By design, it doesn't present and doesn't seek to present a completely flat response in room. There is a small but definable lift. In the old days, Dirac would measure that and then just seek to try and hammer it flat, like a man with a mallet. And the result was technically better, but it stopped your equipment sounding like the equipment that you'd chosen and paid good money for. I've noticed in the last couple of years what's astonishingly impressive about the software like Dirac, and I understand that Room Perfect has been able to do this for longer. Room Perfect and Dirac are now able to identify what is not the room, what is a designed trait of the equipment. Now, if the absolute pursuit of linearity is your goal, you can still apply the EQ mallet, but you don't have to. What you can do is deal with limitations of the space the equipment you like is in, not any character of the equipment that you like. And I feel for me, I mean, there's obviously Palliston and Arundel owners listening to this and going, this is all heresy. You should have something which is flat under all conditions. Well, yeah, you're welcome to do that. It's not necessarily as we've gone on before, in the absence of a defined marker to hit, there's a bit more leeway in two-channel audio. What EQ software has achieved in the last 5 years, maybe a bit less than that, 3 years, is done, it can still do what it's always sought to do, but it does it without causing any grief to the character of the equipment that you happen to be using. No less importantly is the ability to have different curves for different pieces of source equipment, because they don't all respond in the same way and they don't all do the same thing. They bring their own character and issues to the party. And obviously, if you're a vinyl user, you'll be entirely familiar with this. NAD M66 can handle having different inputs for different purposes, different EQ curves for different inputs, I should say. And there's under those conditions, why on earth would you not go for it? Where I'm less bullish is if you're looking at buying an affordable streamer, yes, some of them have got DIY parametric EQ and some of them do not. If you are willing to put in the time and investment into getting results out of that parametric EQ, you might find that it is definitely worth going for the product that has it. But you could just as easily make a complete horlicks of it with the parametric EQ and gain no advantage over a product whose functionality or aesthetic or out-and-out sound quality you end up preferring. So where I am almost unguardedly positive towards some of the better implementations of paid software, parametric EQ is tremendously useful in the right hands, but it is not a magic bullet, and you shouldn't necessarily consider it the be-all and end-all of functionality that has you choose that product over its key rivals. So if that's as much of a sitting on a fence answer as I can give, I mean, that's pretty much where we are. I mean, that would be my take on it. I mean, as I say, I'm fascinated at how you're getting on with some of the two-channel equipment that you're now living with, because, I mean, that's all relatively accurate, but it is not absolutely free of defined character.
It's in two different spaces as well, Ed. So in this room, which everybody's going to get to see in the next month or so, and see the building process and so on, this was a multi-use room. So it needed to be designed in a certain way. Everything's off the floor. Everything's on wheels. It's such a small space. So it needed to have a hardwood floor, which then you need to combat that when it comes to audio, because not only am I recording podcasts in here and making videos in here, I'm also testing audio gear. There is a full 5.1.4 system in here at the minute, and which is M&K. So you're talking subsats. But again, in terms of space, I've had to revert to a 10-inch subwoofer from 2 12-inch dual driving software subs, which took up too much space. So again, I've had to make compromises in terms of that, but that's where designing the room, thinking about how the room's going to be used, then thinking about things like absorption, it's fabric walled and all the rest of it. Whereas the two-channel system, which I'm currently putting together, resides in quite a bright room, which is well furnished, but it doesn't have any of the absorption materials in there. It doesn't have any fabric walls or anything like that at the moment. And again, that's using two floor standing speakers, a streamer and a power amp. So there's no subwoofer to take care of. It's two floor standers. So again, it's careful placement. It's thinking about where the placement is. It's doing the mathematics. It's these are worth the money. It's 120 quid. You can pick them up for about 80 quid if you look around and shop around. I've went with the mini DSP. There's a few different microphones out there. Something like that and a bit of free software immediately gives you an idea of your room and the potential issues. And then once you know what your potential issues are and then how to get around that without using EQ and so on, then that's what you should do first of all. And do that. So it's valuable. It's a valuable tool, but at the end of the day, it's a tool EQ. It's not a savior. It's not going to come along and perform miracles or anything like that. It's like any other tool that you use, whether you're into two channel, whether you're into multi-channel and so on. The issues are the same, and the issue will always be the space within the speaker. Because if you think about it, it's just another big speaker cabinet. It's another big speaker box. So you're putting smaller speakers inside a big speaker box, because it all resonates, it all reflects, it all, and it's how you control that, it's how you get around that issue. And EQ is a fantastic tool, but don't just go into a space and just say, well, I'll use Dirac and it'll fix it.
Fix it in post.
That's always been a saying, you know, I'll fix it in post. No, get it right first of all. Then add your effects and everything else on top and your tools on top to polish it off, to give it that last bit. And that's what EQ is all about. It's just giving it that little bit extra. It's more useful, I think, for people who use subsat systems.
Yes, that's definitely something in that.
Because, you know, trying to blend your satellite and subwoofers together, You could take hours, whereas running, a bit of EQ, once you know the rest of the room's right, run a bit of EQ, that fixes that issue. You could use floor standers and subwoofers and get the crossover perfect using EQ, because you're taking the right measurements. You're then blending that and getting the correct phase and everything else for the room. So these are where it becomes really, really useful.
Yes.
But think about the room first of all. It would always be my takeaway, whether it's audio, video, or whatever. The room is going to have the biggest impact on whatever you're trying to do within that space. And use EQ as a tool to fix the issues that you can't fix by moving things around or thinking about the space you're in and thinking of solutions. And it can be really, really good solutions now. I mean, you can get some lovely bits of artwork that are actually sound diffusers, but made to look like a fantastic piece of work, artwork that you would want on your wall. And again, it's just thinking about the placement of that, thinking about the placement of other things and other things that are in your room, like windows or mirrors or any hard surfaces like that. It's just training yourself to think about what's in the space and what could be potential issue, what could help, and so on. And like you say, at the end of the day, EQ is a tool to use. It's not the one and only solution.
Yes. Amen, brother.
Another contentious question that I always get asked is, when we get a product in for review that has Dirac or Odyssey or YPA or whatever, how do we review it? We review it with and without. Never just with one or the other. Everything's fully tested and tested with EQ switched on and run through properly, and with EQ not in place, because we know our spaces very, very well. We know what what the measurements are for the spaces, what the response should be like, and so on. But it's also interesting if it comes with EQ to check that that all works and how it's implemented and so on. Because again, it could be, I think Dirac's a bit better than it used to be, but there are some software that does vary from product to product and license level to license level. So.
On a more pertinent level as well, when it comes to a lot of Dirac products where the license is not included, we have to review it without the Dirac function, because that's how you will receive it out of the box. It's up to you as to whether you're going to spend the extra money.
Yeah, no, good point.
With items like that, we're always going to do both. And then with parametric EQ, I won't lie, certain times, I mean, with the Eversolo A8, there's no parametric comments on there, simply because it's face-bendingly complicated, and I was already about 3,200 words in.
And the, well,
So,
the other thing is, it's going to vary for
yeah.
each person and each use case and so on. So, yeah, it is there. You can quickly check that it does what it's supposed to do. But at the end of the day, it's going to vary from end user to
Yes.
end user in terms of how you then apply that.
And the WIM, yeah, we've mentioned it, and there'll be a brief comment on it on the Amp Pro as well. But yes, it's one we have to do both. And contentiously, I know that there are some genuine, I would say we're at the point where we have some EQ evangelists on the site, people who genuinely believe it is a must have. I need to point out that even when you've got products as sophisticated as the NAD M66, an unnamed NAD employee, because I imagine there's GDPR issues on this, they can see how many NAD products with supplied licenses, not ones where you buy licenses, ones that have the license inclusive in the price, go on to Dirac and actually start using it. And it is not yet at the 50% level. And that's for products with the license included. So we're some way adrift in reality of where a few people are in terms of their belief of the system and their employment of the hardware concerned.
Yeah. So what's your thoughts? You've heard myself and Ed go through this. What's your experiences with EQ, both positive and negative? Any tips and advice that we maybe haven't gone over in this video that you think might be useful for people who are watching this and so on? If you're watching this on YouTube, then please put your comments in the section down below. And obviously we'll pick up on those and answer those in due course. If you're listening to the full podcast on AV Forums or any other product podcast provider, product provider, then you can head over to AV Forums, find a thread for this podcast in the podcast section and add your questions or thoughts and so on in there. We'd love to hear your thoughts on this. I mean, this is a subject that we could really deep dive on. We could we could have gotten really, really technical. We haven't. We've kind of skimmed along the surface a little bit of this subject. Basically,
we're testing the water.
Yeah, that's basically just to see what kind of feedback we are getting on this, what you guys want to find out a bit more about. If you're interested in stuff like Dirac and so on, we do have interviews that we've done in the past. So you can also go to the podcast page and look up for some of the interviews. I believe we the last Dirac interview we did was probably maybe 2 years ago. So you can look that up as well and go and have a listen where we do deep dive and go into it in quite some detail if you are interested in that. So that wraps up the subject of EQ and my thanks to Ed for that.
No,
now, Ed, before we move on, we need to do your playlist, album and vinyl of the month. So what are they?
Right. Okay. Hang on a second. I've managed to lose it in the excitement. Right. Recommended album. I cannot recommend this one highly enough. This came out on Friday and I haven't stopped listening to it. It's an act, they're not really a group, called Marabou State. They're Americans, don't hold that against them. They've been evolving their sound over a decade now. The latest album is called Hallucinating Love and it's just fabulous. Everything has clicked. It is an absolutely beautiful piece of music. It is available on vinyl, but it is my album of the week. It is available on all the major streaming services. It doesn't overstay its welcome. It is technically electronic, but do not just judge it on the strength of being electronic. There is rather more going on to it than that. Vinyl release, David Gray. Remember David Gray? Well, he's back. He released an album a couple of weeks ago called Dear Life. Is it as good as the album before called Skellig? No, but Skellig was probably, with the possible exception of White Ladder, the best thing he's ever done. So there's only one way to go when you do that. Dear Life is a damn good listen. And he was a bit of a latecomer, thanks to his label, to actually having things on vinyl. But he is nevertheless rather good at it now, or rather the people who work for him are rather good at it. So this is a very, very good listen on analog. And then playlist, I'm a bit late to this because of the nature of the timings, but Cobuzz got in on this and released a playlist of music from David Lynch films to celebrate or at least commemorate the passing of David Lynch. And that's a tremendously invigorating and weird listen and a bit different to the sort of standard arrhythmic beeping that I tend to go in for these podcast for these playlists. So a little bit of a difference for you there. As ever, if you need it on another streaming service, let me know and we can supply you with the link and you can put that into a piece of software called Soundiz and you can turn it into a playlist on any streaming service that you happen to use.
Excellent. Well, that's it for Ed's contribution here to the podcast. Thank you very much, Ed. And we'll catch you in the next one.
Thank you, sir.
Now, there is no home AV section on this month's podcast. And the reason for that is that all the guys are over in Barcelona right now for the ISE show, which is the Integrated Systems Europe show. Massive. And it's all about, integrated systems, security systems, all that kind of thing, custom installation, home theatres. So we'll be finding out all about that in the next podcast when the guys are back here. Some of them are out exhibiting, some out having a look around. So like I say, the guys will all be back next month and we will discuss a little bit about ISE and what's happening in the world of integrated systems and smart homes and all that kind of thing. So let's move on this podcast, the TV section. And at this point, I'm joined by our news editor, Ian Cullen. And in this month's TV section, I was out in Barcelona myself just last week with Philips looking at their new 2025 TV range. So Ian joins me. Hi, Ian.
Hello, how are you doing?
Yeah, good, thanks. Right, so let's get down to what was actually announced. Now, the reason Philips have their event in January is that they are not in the US, so there's no point in them going to CES. The Philips brand in the US is owned by another company altogether. In Europe, it's TP Vision, and that is why they hold their event after CES in Europe, so they can tell us all about their product lineup. Now, Ian, you watched the live event as it happened from Barcelona. So did I. I was sitting there, it was an interesting and I think confident demonstration from Philips. They have got the confidence in the product that they're launching this year.
Yeah. I mean, it's, sorry, excuse me. Yeah, it's, I mean, a little bit different for me because obviously watching it remotely, I only got kind of the slightly shorter version. The actual keynote presentation itself was sort of relatively short compared to some of the longer CES presentations. But yeah, like I say, they packed in a lot of stuff. I mean, there's a lot of stuff excluding TV, excuse me, which you can obviously find on the website covering a lot. I mean, they also announced some soundbars, headphones, turntables, a whole bunch of stuff. But yeah, TV-wise, they've managed to squeeze in quite a lot of interesting developments into a comparative, a small number of models that they actually unveiled at the event. All of which, for me, raise that question of it'll be interesting to see how it compares to, whether that's last year's models or some of the other models that are doing similar things this year. So yeah, it's a very interesting lineup, I thought.
Yeah, so we're not going to get into the turntables and audio and sound bars. But if you are interested in that, that is on the AV Forum's homepage. You can go and have a look or find it in the news section. We do have news stories and images and so on of the other products. We're going to concentrate on TV. Like you hinted at there, Ian, one of the big things that we wanted to find out straight away was which direction Philips were going to take for their flagship TVs, where they're going to finally go with QD OLED. Now, Danny has been looking at QD OLEDs over the last couple of years to see if that's something that they were going to go with. They declined on that this time around again, and they've gone with the primary RGB tandem OLED. Oh, it's such a long-winded name. So this is the technology. If people are not aware, if you haven't been following our CES coverage, this is a new panel design from LG Display. So LG Display are the company who make the panels, not LG Electronics, who sell the TVs. So LG Display, they sell to lots of different companies. We've already seen this panel announced for the LG G5. We've already seen it in the Panasonic. So that's the Z95B, which will be coming later this year. That was announced at CES as well. Philips are going to put it in their two flagship TVs, so OLED plus 950, OLED plus 910. We'll have this panel, and quite surprisingly, Samsung's 83-inch S95F will have this panel as well. The other screen sizes, 55, 65, 77, will be QD OLED in the Samsung lineup, but the 83-inch will be this primary RGB tandem OLED panel, which is from LG Display. So it's a four-stack panel. Basically, what that means is that you got two blues, a red, and a green. Whereas in previous models, you had a three-stack, which was all of those combined. So you had the two blues and you had the combination of the other colors in there. So that's all separated out now into four-stack system. What they are saying here is that Emily got them up in terms of brightness, but there was a few issues with MLA. So that was last year's technology and the year before. So micro lens array, which is tiny, tiny micrometer lenses, which were placed on each of the 8.3 million pixels. They directed light out of the panel towards the viewer. The issue was cost. It cost quite a bit of money to put all of these tiny little convex lenses onto each and every pixel. That added to basically the manufacturing yields and the cost on the back of that. So this primary RGB tandem OLED panel is brighter than MLA. It also has a suggested larger color volume. And what that means is color brightness. So the issue that we've had with WRGB white OLED is basically that the white is there to boost the brightness. But when you're looking at colors like red, green, and blue, and they're getting a lot brighter, especially HDR, that tends to wash out and turn to white because the color volume is not there. Where QD OLED is superior or has been superior to WRGB OLED is the fact that its color volume is huge. It's an RGB system, which means that when you do get brighter, the color keeps its brightness at the brighter level. It doesn't wash out into white. So that's basically as quickly as I can possibly summarize it all together. That's what we're talking about here, and it's an interesting one. I'm hoping to get hands on with one in the next few weeks, just to get initial measurements and so on, because this RGB tandem does look like an interesting way of getting around the issues caused by color dilution in terms of the brighter color, and also adding more color volume in, which I think has been the big advantage of QD OLED, and it'll be interesting to see how much of that gap is closed. So With all that out of the way, that explainer out of the way, so you know what we're talking about going forward. The two flagships, the OLED Plus 950, OLED Plus 910. 950 has 65-77-inch screen sizes, due in September, 9th gen of the dual-engine P5 processor. So it has a little bit more oomph to it than the 910, being the dual-engine. It has a few other image features and so on. There is no Bowers & Wilkins sound system on this. So there's no sound bar at the bottom of the TV, and this is deliberate, and it's a direct result of feedback which has come from you guys out there, AV Forums members, listeners and viewers, all of you talking on the forums. And Philips do read the forums and they do look at your feedback, and some of the events that we've held in the past, they've taken on the feedback that's been given to them. That sound bar is not there because you guys already have your home cinema systems, all your sound bars and everything else, and you don't need a full-on sound system on the flagship TV. You want the best picture, but you don't necessarily want the sound system. And this is the choice that Philips have made this year with the OLED Plus 950. So it does have a 2.1 system on there, but it's not Bowers & Wilkins. It's not branded as Bowers & Wilkins. And that's a big change from OLED Plus 959 from last year, which had really thick chassis and had the full 5.1.2 audio system. This has no audio system on it. It's just the best panel, the best picture processor, and you add your sound system. So really, it's an enthusiast level TV. And we're going to come on to some manufacturers that have done this in the past. But Ian, you know, looking at everything that's on there, they've really gone for it this year in terms of features, in terms of absolutely cutting edge, brand new panel.
Yeah. I mean, and again, it harks back to the point I made at the start about how a lot of the things that are announced have me thinking it'll be interesting to see how it compares to. I mean, I don't know. Am I right in saying that they had a last year's 959 at the event and had that alongside the 950? I mean, I know it would have been sort of very carefully stage managed and how they looked.
It's in the video if people want to go and see that, the video that we launched just on the back of that event. So it was really quite interesting to see. Obviously, 959 is a WRGB, so white OLED. This is still a white OLED, but obviously it has the new tandem four-stack panel in there with better colour and so on. And it was visible. Now, the caveat to that is that this is in the crystal clear, sort of vivid mode. It wasn't in a filmmaker mode. And it's obviously playing material that is designed to show the TVs off at their best. So, and it was the usual Danny Tak demo footage, which is all beautifully shot and color graded and so on. But is it realistic of what you're going to watch in day to day and so on? Maybe not. But it does highlight the differences and the points that they want to get across. So there was a big step up, I thought, not only in brightness and not only in specular highlight details, but definitely in color. Color did look a lot better. Now, the caveat to this as well is that I shot the footage that's in the other video on a DJI Pocket 3. I tried to set it in terms of getting the ISO and everything correct, but it's an annoying little camera that sometimes just goes back into manual mode, from manual into auto. So again, just bear that in mind that the camera will be adding some adjustments to the brightness and ISO settings. But yeah, I got it as well as I could, and you can see differences, but don't read too much into footage from demos and that kind of thing. Demos are there to obviously show the product off. You can wait for our reviews, and we should be getting review samples probably for the 950 roundabout, I would think, August time. We should have a review sample in for that. It's due out in September. Now, the other TV is the OLED Plus 910, so it replaces the 909 from last year. It's available 55, 65, 77. It's going to be available in June. That has the ninth gen single engine P5, but it has the same features, more or less the same features. It just cut down for the power on that model. But it does have a 3.1 Bowers & Wilkins sound system, 8 channels amplification, about 81 watts of power. Very similar to the 909. So if you saw the 909 last year, very similar chassis design, very similar in terms of the design of the soundbar. So it has the same drivers in there. It has the same tweeter with the Nautilus tube on the back of it. And it sounded very, very good. In the demonstrations that we were given by Andy Kerr from Bowers and Wilkins. He had a whole demo room where we watched some actual film clips on the 910, and we're able to listen to the audio system on there. So that looks like a really strong TV, and that's the TV if you do want a decent sound system, as well as you know the best panel and so on. You've got that. The only difference is the single engine chip. That's probably not going to make a huge amount of difference depending on your use case. If you're an absolute film nut, I would go for the 950. You're going to have your own sound system. If you're looking for a more sort of living room friendly, does it all kind of TV, then the 910 is definitely the model to look at there. And I did hint at the fact that one other manufacturer, which was Panasonic, they used to do their 2000 and their 1500 models. Now, the 2000 was the flagship model with a 5.1.2 Dolby Atmos Technics sound system on there. And the 1500 used to have the identical panel. It was the same top-end panel, but did away with the sound system. So you had a choice. You could buy the 2000 with the sound system, or you could buy the 1500 without the sound system, but the same top spec panel. What happened there, and basically reading between the lines and what I've been told off the record and so on, it just didn't sell, the one without the sound system. Now, was that because people didn't want to buy it? I actually think, having listened to a lot of the feedback and listening to people off the record and so on, I think the general consensus was retailers didn't know how to pitch it to consumers, because you had the 2000 to 1500. They really struggled with with selling it without the sound system. The vast majority of customers obviously do go for the sound system that's built in. They're making a big time TV purchase. It's usually for a living room. It's not for the 5 or 10% of the enthusiast market who really already have all this. So that was the case with Panasonic. Will we see the same with Philips? I don't know. I really don't know.
I guess it kind of boils down to what, from my point of view, is what you're buying it for. I mean, I think if I was buying a premium TV, you'd kind of, I don't know whether you'd expect it to come with a premium audio package as well. I mean, I understand that the reasoning is obviously most people, if you're going to buy, if you're spending £3,000 on a TV, the chances are you've probably already got a decent audio system in place anyway. But does, I mean, I guess the big question is, would it see a drop in price from the 950 to cater for the smaller sound system that would justify, you know, that maybe, you know, okay, that's cool. I don't need the sound system. I'm happy to pay a little bit less. Or, you know, does suddenly that make the 910 a more attractive proposition because it does come with a sound system, but maybe the pitch is not quite so good, or the, you know, the performance isn't quite as good because it's got single engine P5 chip. So, I mean, does that make the differences between the two new models more probably more to the consumer as opposed to just how it was last year when they both had similar sound systems? I don't know how much of a difference it would make to the buyers this year, this time around.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see how it does perform. I think Philips are being brave, and kudos to them. They listened to the enthusiast market and they made a TV for enthusiasts. And I really do hope that people out there who have been asking for this on forums and so on, or on Facebook groups, and saying, well, you know, they really should make one without the sound system. Well, there you go. There's one. Go buy it.
Yeah, there's pressure on there.
Because if you're asking for this stuff and so on, and then you don't go and buy it, when you can't really complain at manufacturers if they then next
Yeah.
year come back with one that's got a full-on sound system. It's it's one of them things. I don't know what the sales are going to be like. Like you say, that there is quite a difference in the product, in terms of the one with a built-in sound system does have the single chip. It still has a four-stack RGB tandem panel. It'll still have that color volume. It'll still have the nits performance and so on. So is that a big point for them? The other thing you made, which is really interesting, I hadn't actually considered it until you mentioned it there, Ian, is, yeah, you're right. There's no sound system on this. So and this panel is seemingly cheaper than the MLA panel to produce. So we should be seeing this flagship TV at a lower price point. We won't.
Cross your fingers. Yeah, I was going to say, you know, we can hope, we can dream.
But yeah, that's the two flagships, and I go into them in quite a bit more detail in the video that's already up on our YouTube channel and on Navy Forum. So go and watch that. If you want a little bit more on that. So now, things that we didn't cover in that video and haven't really covered other than news stories on the forums, Ian, is the other TV. So maybe you can walk us through the mini LED.
Yeah, just to sort of quickly wrap those up. I mean, technically, there's two new mini LEDs, mini LEDs. But they've got slightly different branding to last year's. They still come under the Extra banner, as it's called, which is sort of Philips' bridge between those high-end OLEDs and like the standard LED LCD models that they've got a little bit lower down. Last year, they were called the PML. This year, they've got the MLED prefix, which I think probably sounds a little bit better and makes it a little bit clearer what it is for people who maybe aren't entirely sure that they're getting mini LED technologies. One of the interesting additions this year is that Philips has announced that all of its LEDs now come with quantum dot technology, which kind of elevates them into QLED territory. But what
So
we're getting with
again, just to explain to people as well, if they're not familiar with quantum dot technology. So basically, that is, it's a film which lies on the panel or within the panel, depending on what kind of QD-OLED it is. And again, we're talking about color volume. So we're talking about colors as they get brighter, they keep their color. They don't wash out. So that is the advantage of quantum dot. Sorry, Ian, I butt in there, but I think it's
Yeah, no worries.
important to, for
It's
those that
always
don't
good to
know
get
what
that.
the.
Yeah, and I'd be probably one of them to an extent because yeah, it's quite complicated technology. And when they start overlapping, you see, start seeing stories about people that are using sort of QD mini LED technology, but it's not strictly a QD. It's a lot of things to kind of take on board. But yeah, with these two new models, is the as I said, the MLED 950, which comes in 65 and 70, 77 inch sizes, which is due in September. MLED 910 comes in 55, 65, 77, and adds a larger 85-inch model as well, which is due in May. Other than that, quite similar. I think there's a few discrepancies in terms of like the Ambilight technology that they use. Obviously, the brightness on the 950 is a little bit higher than on the 910. And the other thing as well that they use is they both use the Titan OS TV platform rather than Google, which is used on the higher-end OLED. So I think there's been a few improvements there this year. I don't imagine it would be something they would have been showing off too much at the time. It might be something to kind of get a closer look at a bit closer to the launch. But yeah, two new, I don't want to call them flagship, but two new mainstream mini LED models on the way in the Extra range.
So the 950 is the interesting one here. This is their premium mini LED TV. So it sits under OLED, but it is interesting. It comes with a seventh gen P5 processor, which does have some of the adaptive intelligence, as they call it, their AI system. So that's on there. Now, the four-sided Ambilight, this is Ambilight Plus. So if you remember our review of the OLED Plus 959 from just a few months ago, that had Ambilight Plus on it. So this is a new Ambilight system. It has lenses. I think there's about 192 different lenses on the back. And what this does is it's able to give far more gradation to the colors that it's putting behind the TV. And it can also add movement and a lot more movement into that. So it gives it a bit more of a realistic sort of peripheral view when you're watching the TV, if you have it following the video signal or following what's on screen. Really quite an effective new system, which kind of harks back to when they used to have Pico projectors on the back of the TVs many moons ago. Such an expensive TV, that one. But what they learned from that was that those little projectors used to project the image that was on the screen behind the TV as well, and that was too distracting. So the new system here is designed to add the movement, to add the gradation in the color and so on, but not to the extent that it will be a distraction to the viewer. And I had the 959 here for a few weeks and lived with it, and it really is a nice addition to the Ambilight family. And the advantage here is that it's four-sided, and whereas the 959 was three-sided. So yeah, you're getting the improved Ambilight system on there, which is a big plus. The Tizen OS system, it looks sorry, Titan, not Tizen. Titan looks interesting. It should also have a lot of the catch-up services on it if it follows through on the promise there. That's one of the issues with the flagship OLEDs, is that the Google TV doesn't have BBC iPlayer on there. I think it does have ITV and maybe Channel 4 and 5, but BBC, certainly last year's models, and I believe this year's models will not have that on the Google TV system. That's one of the drawbacks of Google. So yeah, very interesting in terms of the mini LEDs. I'm hoping that we will also get them in for review because we haven't had a look at them for a number of years. But the certainly the 950, it's an interesting looking TV, which I wouldn't mind getting that in for review. The other LCD TV that QLED I think we need to discuss, Ian, is the one. This has been a fantastic marketing strategy from Philips. It's not something that we've really covered on AV forums because we tend to go from the mid-level and higher end because that in terms of our audience is what they're interested in the most. But certainly for the ordinary consumer out there, somebody who's just looking for a TV that has a lots of features, lots of screen sizes and so on, the one, which is the PUS 9000 series, it's been a real successful story for Philips in terms of getting people into the brand, getting people buying the TV and so on. And this is now Quantum Dot as well. So they've added Quantum Dot to this now. So this is a QLED TV. It's got Ambilight on there. Screen sizes 43, 50, 55, 65, 77, and 85. It'll come to market around about April as well. So that's it's a really interesting TV. And you know what? I'm going to badger them this year because I want one in for review just to see how it stacks up against other TVs at that level of the market. So yeah, great marketing point. You know, this is the TV. This is the one that you need. If you're just looking for a TV that does everything, going to sit in your living room and you're not that fussed about, you know, director's intent and image accuracy and that kind of thing, but you want all the features on there, including the P5 processor and so on. It's on there, and it's a reasonably priced TV as well. It's an affordable TV. Just wrapping up. I think I said ninth gen, and it's not. Take that back. It doesn't have P5. The one. Right. So the last TVs to discuss are OLEDs. So a step down, a rung down from the flagship models. They don't have the plus moniker, so they're just the OLED TVs. So 810, it looks interesting. Ian, tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, 810. It's using improved OLEDX technology from my perspective, and the press release and the announcement they made, they didn't go into a great deal of detail about how exactly that technology has improved over last year's models. But obviously they're promising the usual in terms of, improved peak brightness up to, I think it's 1500 nits for the 810, for the 55-inch model and above. It comes with the ninth gen P5 processor, same as the new OLED Plus models as well. So there's all the new features that come with that associated with. And also it's got a 2.1 audio system, which now you can say is the same as the OLED Plus 959. So in that respect, it's almost comparable. As you say, three-sided Ambilight system. So yeah, it's one of those where it comes with a lot of very good features. So it'll be interesting to see how price-wise it compares. For people that maybe that don't want to pay the extra and don't need the sound system, could be
Yeah,
a
and I do like what Philips are doing with the smaller screen sizes. So unlike other manufacturers where C4 or G5 from sorry, C5 G5 from LG, when you get into 48, 42 and different screen sizes, the panel changes. So you're not getting the premium panel. Philips don't do that. You get your premium panel, but they do it at the screen sizes where that panel is available. They don't then try and put in a 48-inch, but it's got a different panel and different. They stay away from that. So I really like that Philips do that. So the 800 series, the 810, it comes in 42, 48, 55, 65, and 77-inch. So you've got a full range of screen sizes there. And this is their affordable OLED lineup. So this is the one that is going to sell. The 809 sold last year. In big numbers as well because it offered all the screen sizes and very, very good technology at the price point. And interesting again that there's a 7 series OLED coming to the UK as well. So that's the OLED 760. Again, 48, 55, 65, 77. It's due in May. It has an improved EX panel, 1000 nits peak, 7th gen P5, three-sided Ambilight, and the Titan OS system and game bar as well. So again, it's another interesting model. And again, one of the interesting things to pick up on there is the 7th gen P5, because it's using a lower end but newer Pentonic system on chip, it comes with four HDMI 2.1 inputs, where all the other OLED TVs don't. They only have two HDMI 2.1, but they use the higher end process and power on that. So that's the reason why that one has four. And again, it's one of these confusing things, but it's because they're buying things off the shelf, and the Pentonic that is powerful enough to drive the ninth gen P5, it only comes with two unless they go up to the next system on chip, which then adds to the cost. So to try and meet the cost and the processing power, they've had to go with the two HDMI 2.1 inputs. That's the reasoning behind that one. But anyway, Ian, interesting lineup. I think we've seen all the TVs now, haven't we, this year? I think everybody's kind of shown their hand a little bit. We're just waiting on the UK launch events now.
Yeah. I mean, you still expect there to be a few more to come, maybe, a little bit further in the year. I'm not sure entirely what to expect. There's kind of people maybe hoping that Sony might still have something up their sleeve for a little bit later in the
Oh,
year.
Sony's got something up their sleeve. I think if I see in the video as well, I think if you're one for placing bets, it's going to be interesting to see if they go QD OLED or if they jump on the RGB primary RGB tandem OLED. I'm just going to call it four stack going ahead. Interesting to see if they jump on the four stack. I think that's what everybody's waiting on, just to see what Sony are actually going to do. But I think everybody else is kind of showing their hands. And like I say, hopefully the next few weeks I'm going to get my hands on one of these new panels anyway to have a good look at and maybe get some measurements and so on, and we get a better idea of how this four stack panel is going to stack up for this year. There you go, bit of humor added in there.
Right. I was coughing. I wasn't joking on
All right, okay. I thought you were laughing at my joke, but you're just joking.
I
Come
was
on.
stifling. I was laughing on the inside. No,
Right.
I'd have been proud of that one. That's good.
So that wraps up our look at the Philips TVs. Thank you very much, Ian. Ian, before you go, would you like to do the competitions and supporters for us?
I would love to, yeah. Competitions, what do we have? We've got two excellent competitions on the go at the moment that everybody is heartily encouraged to enter, starting big time with Valencia Theatre Seating. You've got single Tuscany Ultimate XL chair, which is worth £2,100, which must make it a very, very comfortable chair. That competition's being timed in conjunction with Global Movie Day, which I didn't know what a thing was a thing, but apparently it is. So if you want to celebrate that in style, you can get yourself a Valencia Theatre Seating Ultimate XL chair. All you have to do is just answer a simple question on the website, and you've got until the end of March 2025 to get your entry in. So you've got a little bit of time to play with, but enter today before you forget all about it. It's a great chance to win a what looks like an extremely comfortable chair. Also on the go right now, you could win a Fell Amp from Fell Audio, which is worth £599. That's to celebrate the launch of the, well, call it brand new, they've been around for a few months now. Fell Audio, you can win their debut Fell Amp, and you've got until Friday, February the 28th to get your entry in for that one. So not quite so long, but still a little bit of time to play with. But yeah, like I say, enter today, don't want to miss out. As always, there's a wealth of disc competitions on the go as well, so you can win DVDs, Blu-rays, 4K discs. For both patrons and standard AVF members, just get your names in the hat to win those. There's always loads of good stuff to get your hands and eyes on. All these competitions are eligible to AV Forums members who are over 18 and residents in the UK. So just head over to avforums.com/competitions to enter.
Okay, thank you very much for that, Ian. And previous winners, we've got a couple here.
Oh, sorry, I was carrying on. Sorry. Yeah, this is just proof that people do actually win this stuff. We have Geo GT 600. Has won himself or herself a pair of Polk Audio Signature Elite floor standing speakers from Peter Tyson that are worth £899. Nelly has won themselves a JBL MA310 5.2 channel 4K AV receiver worth £499. And London Guy 1973 has won themselves a JBL Extreme 4 portable Bluetooth speaker, which is worth £330. So hopefully all of those will get to enjoy those prizes very, very soon if they're not already. And we could also give a nod to some new patrons, Dabbler, James, and Richard Hanna. Welcome on board. And we also need to give a thanks to some people who have bought us a coffee, which includes Suspiria XXX and someone, which I'm reliably informed is more than one person. This is actually the people who have contributed but didn't give us a name. So thank you to all of those people who have helped and supported us.
Yeah, thank you very much to our supporters. It really is appreciated your help. It really does help us out at the end. Right, so that's it for our first AV Forums podcast of 2025. It's all done. My thanks to Ed and Ian. Our next available episode will be on the 10th of March, which is a Monday again, while the next edition of the Screen Time with AV Forums podcast will be available Monday, the 24th of February, as an audio only. And of course, like this podcast, there will be a video releases as well on the YouTube channel. So go and find those on the AV Forums YouTube channel and, of course, on the Screen Time with AV Forums YouTube channel as well. Don't forget to do the usual social media stuff. If you do like what we do here, if you want more people to come and join us on the podcast and listen to us and so on, then please do get the word out on social media and other platforms. It really is appreciated. And, of course, if you really liked this podcast, you could buy us a coffee at buymeacoffee.com/AV Forums. I'm Phil Hinton. Thank you very much for listening, and we'll see you again soon.